Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
That is really kind of the sad news, probably more so for people of my age or than the younger people, but Curly Neal dying. You know, the Harlem Globetrotters obviously are not the same or not what they were when I was younger and growing up. They were still pretty much a really big attraction. And, of course, Curly Neal was, for a lot of years, the star of the show, along with Meadowlark Lemon. He basically was... one of probably, if you really want to look at the history of the Globetrotters, he's probably one of the four or five most recognizable and popular players from all of those teams. I mean, he was a guy that did all of the really showmanship-type dribbling drills and, you know, always was able to do a whole lot of different things. Of course, he was really good at interacting with the crowd and having a lot of fun, but it's kind of interesting, like, when you think about Curly Neal and you think about the, you know, what the Globetrotters used to be, it's a little bit of a shame that they aren't the same. I mean, I know that they still do tour and people still go to see them, but it's not nearly what it used to be. And I think that's a shame because I don't know that enough people really understand or know what the history of the Harlem Globetrotters is. I mean, there are a lot of people nowadays, or people even my age, you know, and I'm 50, they basically think of the Harlem Globetrotters as sort of this fun, fun-loving bunch that goes and they play these quote-unquote basketball games against the Washington Generals, and they have fun and do all kinds of different things with the crowd and, you know, fake buckets of water that turned out to be confetti and hiding the basketball under their shirt and all the other stuff that they do. But really, I mean, what their history is they were actually a really good basketball team. And they basically would play, you know, would play against back in the day. I mean, all of the white players basically were playing, you know, in the NBA or whatever the NBA was called back then. It was the NBA, and before that, I think it was the NBL or something, whatever. But they would play those teams, you know, and even though they were founded in Chicago, Abe Saperstein, who was the guy that founded them, he wanted everybody to know that they were going to come and watch an all-black team, which is where the name the Harlem Globetrotters came from. I mean, we figured, you know, Harlem is an area that's most associated as a black neighborhood, and it's a really famous black neighborhood. And so he basically said, listen, I'm gonna name this team the Harlem Globetrotters. So, I mean, at that time, you know, Harlem was sort of the, you know, the center of really the African-American community all across the country. I mean, Harlem was sort of the biggest neighborhood, and so it was pretty clear that people were going to buy tickets. They were coming to see an African-American team. And, of course, they would play all of the NBA teams They had a famous game against the Lakers. They had a famous game against the Celtics. And then of course, in the early 50s, the Globetrotters, all of a sudden, some of their players started getting drafted. Signed by NBA teams. So, you know, it really is a very historical organization. I mean, we talk about it now and it's completely different, and I think most people that are young, especially younger people, you know, they don't really understand or know what the Globetrotters used to be and what they stood for and how they came about. So the fact that, you know, Curly Neal and, you know, died today, that's really what it brought back for me, because I used to go to the Globetrotters games when I was young. But I think one of the things that really I was shocked to find out the whole history of it when I worked at the NBA. I did a couple of different stories writing about the Harlem Globetrotters and talking to some of the historical people and all the other stuff. So to me, it's a sad day. We talk a lot about all these other things, but we don't necessarily, we talk a lot about all these other athletes and things of the such, but sometimes I think we don't necessarily look at somebody like Curly Neal as being a great athlete. But he was obviously, he was a tremendous basketball player. I mean, that was the thing that was the great unknown about the Globetrotters, even, you know, into the 80s and 90s. Those teams were loaded with really good basketball players. It wasn't just, you know, a bunch of clowns. I mean, they really were really good basketball players, and they probably, I would be willing to bet that the Globetrotters, even into the 80s and 90s, probably could beat some CBA teams. Now, probably not NBA teams at that point, because, you know, most of the African-American players that were really good were playing in the NBA. But I bet you that some of those teams in the late 80s and early 90s would still have been able to beat a couple of CBA teams and all the other stuff. I mean, but I've done a number of different stories about the Globetrotters and their history, and I'm always fascinated. You know, they would go around some of these places. They would do these barnstorming tours where they would be playing in, like, these all-white towns in Iowa and in Indiana and Illinois. They'd play against pretty much anybody that wanted to play against them. And they were able to get some teams that basically, you know, for a while there, they were able to get some of the NBA teams to play them. And they actually beat them back then. But, of course, you know, a couple of the guys that you probably heard of from that era, Chuck Cooper, Nat Sweetwater Clifton, both of those guys became among the first, they were the first black players of the NBA. So it really was, if you really ever want to look at a history of an organization and find it really fascinating, the Globetrotters, to me, are one of those institutions that we should do everything in our power to try and preserve. Because I think that there's a lot of history that can be, you know, that can be taught, that can be learned around their story. And I think that's one of those things where, I don't necessarily think all the time, take enough time to really think about how you preserve history, how you teach history. I mean, again, a lot of these younger kids and younger people, and even, you know, people that maybe even aren't even, you know, I'm talking people in their 20s and 30s, probably a lot of them don't really understand what life was like back then. I mean, even into the 60s and 70s, in terms of different forms of segregation and stuff, but especially, in the 40s and 50s, there were a lot of different outlets that, like Negro League baseball that we talk a lot about. Well, this was basically, you know, Negro League basketball. I mean, think about the NBA now, think about basketball now, and think about the fact that back then, the Negro League was pretty much one team of like 12 guys that did barnstorming tours. So anyway, rest in peace. Curly Neal to me is one of my, you know, one of the people talk about the athletes that you looked up to growing up. You know, there's a lot of guys that, you know, I name. One of them is always Curly Neal, even though he played for the Globetrotters. And I think if I'm not mistaken, the Globetrotters were really the only team he ever played for. I think he played for them for like 20 to 25 years. So he never really played for a quote-unquote legitimate real basketball team. But he's obviously somebody that you cannot tell the story in the history of basketball without including Curly Neal and Metal Luck Lemon. And if you look at some of the guys that played for the Harlem Globetrotters, you'd be shocked at the names of some of the guys that probably names that you recognize. In fact, the first non-black Harlem Globetrotter actually played at Pitt, Orlando Antigua. But anyway, rest in peace, Curly Neal. It's a tough thing anytime you lose a legend, anytime you lose anybody especially, but when someone is sort of a childhood, boyhood hero type thing, it really is a tough day. So rest in peace, Curly Neal. The Paul Zeiss Show brought to you by Archie's on Carson Street. Get down to Archie's, the official chicken wing of the Fan. Archie's open 5 o'clock every night for takeout. So, get down and get some wings and things of the such from Archie's. You can follow us on Twitter at 93.7 The Fan, driven by Jim Shorkey Kia. Pittsburgh's number one Kia dealer. Shop all three locations at ShorkeyKia.com. Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. I'm Paul Zeiss. It is the Paul Zeiss Show. We are we're moving right along. 412-928-9370 is the number of the Edgar Snyder & Associates fan text line. Edgar Snyder & Associates reminds you to text responsibly. You just heard from Derek Watt, who you heard a little bit. We'll hear more from him later. But it's interesting he's talking about coming to Pittsburgh because this is a, tough, hard-nosed. And it's funny, the stereotype that is always out there when it comes to Pittsburgh teams is, especially the Steelers. Well, they're the hard-nosed, tough, defensive-minded, and all that other stuff. But what's interesting is, he's joining a team that probably hasn't been that in a couple of years. I mean, this is one of those things where the stereotype of the Steelers, what we traditionally think about the Steelers, probably doesn't add up to what they actually are. They used to be a team that, they were 3 yards in a cloud of dust and a hard-nosed team and all that other stuff. But they've become, over the past few years, they had sort of become a little bit of a pass-happy finesse team, haven't they? I mean, their defense is still pretty good, and their defense this year was really good. But really, if you take a look at what the offense has become, and Watt was probably signed, the reason that they brought him here was because they probably would love to get back to a little bit of that kind of blue-collar, hard-nosed mentality. I mean, I think that they would want, they think they want to try and become a team that grinds it out a little bit, a team that isn't so reliant on just throwing the ball over the place. I mean, that's the biggest thing to me. You have to figure that out. How in the world can you get that back and balance it with, you're getting Ben Roethlisberger back, and so, we're going to have to throw the ball a little bit more because he likes throwing it. That's the thing. I would say that is the biggest thing. How do you balance becoming a running team again with the fact that you are a team that has a, you know, quote unquote elite quarterback who's, you know, a veteran who has proven himself in a lot of ways, who has shown that he likes to throw the ball a lot and likes to, you know, be in shotgun and likes to have a lot of receivers on the field. I mean, how do you balance that? I think that is going to be, you know, the toughest thing they've got to do on offense in training camp is figure out how to kind of keep everybody happy. How do you keep everybody happy? That's what it's going to be. That's what it's going to come down to. And, you know, I think the one thing we've seen from Ben Roethlisberger is while he is, you know, somewhat sometimes likes to defer to, you know, the coaches and whatnot, he's also sometimes had a little bit of a, you know, like a spoiled brat kind of attitude about it. And so, you know, my guess is if they're going to get back to being this hard-nosed team, there could be a little bit of kicking and screaming from him. But I would say this, if you point out, hey, Ben, you know what, 2 years ago you threw for 5,000 yards and, you know, you averaged however many attempts a game, and you had a bunch of, you know, really big throwing days, and we missed the playoffs. I mean, I think when this offense has been at its best and its most effective is when it's had the ability to run the ball a little bit and with authority. And obviously having Le'Veon Bell helped, but even with Le'Veon Bell, I kind of felt like this was more of a finesse team. You know, he was more of a weapon out of the backfield, and, you know, they had a hard time picking up those third and shorts. They were just not a team that was built to line up and knock you kind of on your ass. So I think that, you know, Derek Watt talking about how this is a blue-collar team and a hard-nosed team and all that stuff, a lot of that is just based on reputation. I mean, probably not. You know, it's probably less so true than it was, you know, maybe, I don't know, you know, six, seven, eight, 9 years ago. So, you know, you bring in a guy like Matt Canada, though. I think one of the things that happens when you do bring in a guy like Matt Canada, you know, everybody assumes that he's going to have his hands in the offense, and he will. I don't know that he'll have it in as much as some people think. But I do think having a guy that has called plays come in, even as a quarterback's coach, I think it's going to be pretty interesting to see his influence on the offense. And I think, you know, I would point to the defense last year when they had Terrell Austin and brought him in as a secondary coach. If you remember, they brought him in. He was a secondary coach. And, you know, nobody really talked about that move very much. He was supposed to be the guy that sort of helped with trying to he was supposed to be the guy that was supposed to help with the challenges and all the other stuff with Mike Tomlin. He was going to help out with some of the game management type stuff. And he was going to do a lot of that stuff. He was really going to try and, you know, be that guy. And there was a couple of challenges they lost, and that was when his name. I don't believe that that was really the most important thing that he did. I don't. I think that when you look at the defense, there were little tweaks in it. There were some differences in some of the blitzes that they did. There was a little bit of difference in some of the coverages that they did. He clearly, you know, because he was a defensive coordinator for a number of years, he clearly had his fingers in the defense and his influence on the defense. And, you know, when people talk about, well, the defense, you know, it was really good because of, it was really, really good because of what happened in terms of them getting Minka Fitzpatrick and all that other stuff. No, that was a definitely important. I think obviously Bud Dupree, having a better year in terms of rushing the passer was important. But I don't think we talk nearly enough about the influence that Terrell Austin had on the defense and the different little wrinkles and things that he brought to the defense that probably had a big, big impact at the end of the day. So I think that when you look at it from that standpoint, I think the Matt Canada move will be very similar. And I think that, you know, one of the things that he's going to probably do is bring a better running game and bring a running game that is going to be a little bit more based on power. And that's why I just have a feeling we're going to see Watt more than we saw Roosevelt Nix. I have a feeling we're going to see him more. I have a feeling they're going to use him more. Maybe not to run the ball, but I have a feeling that they're going to put him in some short yardage stuff. And, you know, I think that this is going to be a year where they get back to sort of what he's talking about. I don't think now they're going to turn into 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Ben would never let that happen. But I also don't think they're going to let him throw the ball 40 times a game either. So that is really a delicate balance that they're going to have to find. They're going to have to try and figure out what it is that is the perfect mix to keep Ben happy and also to be, to keep Ben happy, but also to be more effective, more efficient, make less mistakes. I think one of the things you want to do is if you can start to become really efficient at the short yardage stuff, which I think you can do when you have a fullback and you have a guy like James Conner in your backfield and you have the weapons that you have, I think you can become pretty good at the whole short yardage thing again. But as Derek Watt said, you know, this is sort of who they are and all the other stuff. I don't know. I think that the Steelers haven't been that for a while. And I, you know, here's the other thing. I don't necessarily know that people really want the Steelers to go completely back to that. But I think that if you look at where they're at, they've got to get some a more concerted running game back involved in what they're doing. It's just a really difficult balance to strike when you've got a quarterback that doesn't really want to give up that kind of control, you know. But you hope that he looks and says, okay, well, you know, we didn't win doing it this other way, so maybe we need to do it where we get back to trying to run the ball and trying to get into a place where, trying to get into a place where we can be a power running team on third down and things of the such. I just feel like that's the way that they're going to go. And so this is going to be an interesting off season, especially if this thing that we're talking about, the larger issue, if that continues, how long is it going to continue? And I think, if it continues into, you know, May and June, now we're talking about, you know, getting rid of OTAs and getting rid of mini camps and that. I mean, you still have training camp, but in terms of installing an offense or installing a new part of the offense, it'll be interesting to see how not just the Steelers, really, but all these other teams do it. How are they going to do it if they're not going to be able to have access to the players and all the other stuff? It's just going to be a completely different situation. And I think it goes for all sports, and including football. And that's where it comes down to what are you going to do in the off season here to change whatever it was that caused you to miss the playoffs last year. And in the Steelers' case, it's they've got to get better at offense and they got to get back to sort of what Derek Watt is saying, that that's who they are. You know, again, they're not or haven't been that team for a number of years. So if they're going to get back to it and they're going to run the ball with efficiency and they're going to run the ball and be tough like that, then all of a sudden, if you look at it, they're going to have a chance, I think, to be a pretty scary offense and to be a pretty scary team, you know, given their defense. So we just got to watch it, and we got to watch the way that this thing evolves. But I really believe that we will see a lot more of Derek Watt than we saw of Roosevelt Nix the last few years. I just do. I think it's going to be one of those things where he's going to be a big part of the offense, and maybe not running the football, and not, you know, where he's on the field 80% of the plays. But I do think that he will be on the he will be on the field more than we're used to seeing a fullback. 412-928-9370 is the number. It's the Paul Zeiss Show. It is 93.7 The Fan. Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. I'm Paul Zeiss. It's the Paul Zeiss Show. 412-928-9370 is the number. If you want to call and talk sports, well, today we were supposed to hear a baseball game, and that baseball game would have been the Pirates and the Rays. In fact, it would have been on this very network, the Pirates and the Rays, as it was supposed to be opening day. And I think that it's really starting now to settle in what the situation is that we're in. You know, opening day, you know, was supposed to be today. Obviously, we've seen a whole lot of other stuff. You hear Sidney Crosby talking about, boy, I hope we can just play the playoffs. But what's interesting with this is, you know, Rob Manfred is talking about a lot of different scenarios in terms of how they're going to figure out what they're going to do. But I wanted to, you know, we did have a baseball game on, by the way. I guess it would have been the 1960 Mazeroski home run game was on, in case you know, we're going to do some of that over the next few weeks. We're going to do some of that stuff, classic baseball games we're going to play, and hopefully, you know, you enjoy it. I mean, we eventually want to be playing, you know, baseball games that are going on right now. But what we hope is, you know, that if in the meantime you enjoy some of the games that we have, and I think that, you know, we're going to play a number of different games throughout the course of the next few weeks. I mean, obviously today we played the most famous, I would say that's probably the most famous game, the Game 7. Of the World Series, where, you know, the Mazeroski home run game. Interesting, like I say, I'm always amazed by that thing. You know, it was 10-9. I think there was like 13 pitchers or 11 pitchers or 12, something like that, between the two teams that were used. And it was, you know, 10-9, and it really, the game literally was done in like 2 hours and 30 minutes. I mean, nowadays, that kind of a playoff game with that many pitchers and that many runs scored, that would have been a five-hour game. I mean, if you think about playoff baseball now and how it's changed in a lot of ways, I mean, baseball in general has changed. But that game, the way that it was played, the number of runs that were scored, the pitching changes, and as a result of all the bad, you know, the guys on base, the number of, you know, strategical moves that were probably made, all of those things, you know, that game would have taken probably close to 5 hours, 4 hours and 45-minute type game, if it were a playoff game now. But it was done in like 2.5 hours, which I think is pretty cool. I mean, to me, it's like one of those box scores you look at and you say, boy, that can't be right, is it? It can't be right, but it is. So I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think that, you know, playing those games, we've got a couple more coming up that you might be interested in. Obviously, a couple from the 90s. You have Doug Drabeck, game five against, I think it was the, it would have been the Reds. Yeah, Drabeck against the Reds. We have that coming up. We have the wild card game coming up. We have some great, great games. 1979 World Series, all four of the wins from the Pirates. So, you know, if you're interested or into historical Pirate games, obviously this is the place to be for the next few weeks. But, you know, my question is, I wonder how many people out there were really, really looking forward to opening day. And I think that it's tough to gauge now because we've been sort of distracted from what we were, you know, but I wonder if there's a lot of people that were really getting fired up for opening day. I know there's a number of people who opening day is a big deal, and of course they were going to open on the road. That was what was supposed to happen. They were going to be in Tampa, but next week they were, you know, they would have had the opening day here, and I know a lot of people really getting, you know, up for that. This year, I didn't sense that there was as much excitement for the season to start. But I think that opening day is still, you know, even though I think there were predictions of a number of people that there wasn't going to be nearly as big of a crowd this year because of the, you know, offseason that the Pirates had, I do think there would have been a pretty good crowd. And I think that, you know, I can think of like a group from Ohio that always comes in and, you know, for opening day, and they, you know, make a bus trip out of it, and a number of different things like that. When it comes to opening day, we've had a lot of people that have, you know, have really looked forward to it in the past. But this year, I didn't sense that nearly as much. I didn't really sense that because I think it was basically, you know, the off season. And the move that seemed to be the one that really just kind of turned people off a little bit was basically the move to get rid of Starling Marte, trade Starling Marte. I mean, I think that was the one where people said, okay, well, this team isn't really trying to win. And so, you know, when, you know, I would think, and what will be interesting is that the, what would be interesting is that now, because of what we're going through here and the fact that we don't have sports and we don't have baseball and we don't have football and we don't have, you know, hockey and in the NBA and all the other stuff, what will be interesting is now what will be the anticipation for opening day now. I mean, I think sometimes when you have a big life-changing type of event or, you know, whatever you want to call it, I think basically people's attitudes and things change. I think what will happen is people are going to appreciate stuff probably a little bit more. And so I really believe that while people probably were not all that excited about this season to start, and I don't know that they were looking forward to it that much, I would be willing to bet that now, you know, say, and they're talking about baseball coming back maybe June 1st. I mean, if you think about June 1st, boy, that's a long way from here. But, you know, if it comes back June 1st, that means May 1st, probably right around May 1st, they'll start opening up, you know, training camps and things. And, you know, at least that'll be a sign that maybe we're getting back to our life a little bit. But my thing is, June 1st, if baseball doesn't come back until May 1st or June 1st, I really believe the anticipation and the eagerness and the excitement will be probably greater than for just about any season since, you know, 2014 or 15, or, you know, after the first wild card year, you know, the people were excited, really excited about this team. Or even, you know, the first year they were in PNC Park. I think what happens a lot of times is when we lose something, you appreciate it more. When you have to live without something, you appreciate it more. And I think we will all probably learn to appreciate things more. And frankly, the first sporting event that happens when we open, you know, back up for business, the first sporting event that happens, I imagine it's going to be met with unbelievable reception. Like, for instance, if the NHL is the first one to come back, and they have, you know, a night where they've got two playoff games or three playoff games, they'll be among three of the highest rated hockey games probably of all time. And I think that that's going to be interesting to see how it affects the Pirates. Because like I said, I didn't sense that there was a lot of people all that excited about the start of the season with the Pirates. But now, I think people are starving already. And, you know, it's what, March 26th or 27th or whatever it is? I mean, June 1st is a long way from here. And so, you know, May 1st is a long way from here. And so, you know, if you look at it from that standpoint, you know, pushing back the season a little bit, people are really going to be, I think, more eager and more excited about the start of the Pirates season and maybe even the whole season. I mean, if you go from 81 home games to, say, 50 home games like they're talking, I don't know. I think that there's going to be more demand for the games, and especially now that we've gotten a taste of what it's like to not have games. You know, we've gotten spoiled in a lot of ways. We've gotten really spoiled to, you know, like I said, to the point where you've got, you know, every night you turn on the TV and there's, you know, multiple games from multiple sports every single night, now to the point where there's nothing going on. And there's no sports. So I think it'll be interesting to see what it looks like when it all opens up. But today was supposed to be opening day, and I don't know that a lot of people were really, you know, anticipating opening day all that much. And there's probably a number of people in this town that didn't even realize the Pirates were supposed to play today. But I guarantee you this, June 1st, June 10th, June 15th, whatever the first date is for regular season games to start playing, I guarantee you people will be hungry for it and will be more excited than they've ever been for Pirates baseball.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.